That was actually On a Spring Note. The composer was Sidney Torch. It was by the New London Orchestra, conducted by the great Ronald Court, whom I've met. And it's part of this light classical music, British light classical music of the 20th century, especially the middle part of it. It's a strangely neglected area of music, one which I'm very fond of. This music is, once you get it beyond its comedy value, which most people of my age would see, because it was once upon a time it was the only thing on the radio before rock and roll. You just heard it everywhere. It's incredibly breezy, it's fiendishly clever. There is something comedic about it, and I immediately think of the post-war garden. It does evoke a garden. There's Mr. Brown, he's off to work now. That's right, Mrs. Brown. No, don't invite the milkman in yet. And you can just hear someone say, "We're breaking into our broadcast for the second time tonight to bring you this." And everything about it is beeb and solid and good, because it's prefixed with the term light, I suppose. And anything light, like light verse, you can't win, because, you know, the British intelligentsia, they will, if it says light, that means it can't be. Yes, I suppose there is a place for light music in the pantheon of the greats, and that would go the same with poetry.
Jetzt darauf, dass
That was Diese Nacht by Eva Schwalbe. Eva Schwalbe is a German opera singer. She's specialised in Brecht and Weill sort of stuff. But she lives in France with her husband, François Rebec. François is, well, I suppose, what some people would call an avant-garde composer. He's not quite avant-garde, but he's definitely on the artistic side. It's not pop music what he does, but it's very good, and I've worked with them a couple of times, usually doing English words for those bits that need English. He does multinational productions, so some will be in German, some will be in French, and a little bit will be in English. And he will usually prevail upon Carl Coughlan as well, who was with Micro Disney and Fatima Mansions. And occasionally, I will go out there. I'm not a great traveller, but I will go out to France, usually to see Francois. And Ava has an extraordinary voice. And this was an entire opera about a garden, which I had to be involved in. And I actually went out to see it, not in Paris or Rennes, where I could have seen it. And I do not know if the thing has ever come out on record. That is my private burn of that track, which I usually play at least once a week. I like it so much. In spring, the lesser celandine slung stars across the unmown lawn. The Kerrier japonica would rival it, the blossoms born competing for a courting sun, each flower like a lion's mane that sparkled in the early rain, shinier than cellophane. A solitary hyacinth, the broken birdbath on a plinth, its grey stone mermaid pocked and mossed, the fractured top attacked by frost. It wore a certain dignity conferred by its antiquity. Now tulips fought through sticky weed for space beneath the elder trees. A shabby blackbird shadowed me, whistled at me on my knees, pulling annual mercury. My favourite type of gardening, the kind of gardening I did as a jobbing gardener. You know, everybody these days is a landscaper or a makeover artist or something like that. I wasn't. My hero when I was a kid was an old boy who lived two doors down the road from my granny called Mr. Sigroves. He actually had a growth on his head, and a rather uncharitable teenage friend of mine used to call him Mr. Sidegrowth. And he would come in and see Mrs. A, my landlady at the time, and he'd do her garden, and he'd rub her legs for her sometimes. She had very bad circulation. You'd come in and find this old gardener with moustache, puffing and grunting, sort of massaging her lower leg. You think, what's going on here? And if this Mr. Sigroves is massaging my leg, aren't you, Mr. Sigroves? And he said, how is your... It was a big cyst or something. It was nearly as big as his head, this thing growing on it. And I'd say, how's it going? And he'd say, go... Yeah, he said, it burst this morning. You should have seen the muck what came out of it. But aside from that, yeah, Mr. Sigroves, Sid we used to call him, I think his name might have been George. He was a really good jobbing gardener, and you'd see him cycling everywhere. My granddad, you know, got me to do hedges, so I became interested in gardening. And I wanted to be that kind of gardener, just a little old boy on a bike. I thought this would be, you know, if I didn't become a pop star or you know, famous for just being stunningly talented or something, that I could be, neither of which has resulted yet, I could just be a pretty good old boy on a bike. I'd be pretty convincing and just going around doing a bit of digging. And in actual fact, I have done that. When I've been forced to do an honest job, that's what I've done. And the jobs I enjoy most are the Jungle Bash. And in a town such as the one where I live, in Essex, there are many academics, and you tend to be doing jobs in, with any luck, in old houses for academics who are just a little bit, who love the garden, but are either not quite knowledgeable enough to do them, haven't got time to do them, or are a little bit frail to do them. And my favourite jobs have always been for old guys who love their gardens. And you do, you say, do you know, Professor so-and-so, I found a path down there with a small statue in it. He said, oh, yes, I knew it was there. And I said, well, when did you last see it? Oh, I suppose about 10 years ago, you know, before my wife died or something like that. You know, and that is good, but there aren't too many huge gardens where I live. I used to do a garden for an old doctor, but he kept pretty much on top of it. But I like a garden you can get lost in. But you don't actually need much of a garden to get lost in if it's going to get overgrown. It's pretty hard to make a terrible mistake in gardening unless you got a can of Agent Orange or a flamethrower or something when you weren't required to. But I once chopped down by accident. Well, it was the woman, you know, who I was working for. It was somewhere up in the estates. I shan't say who she isn't. But she just said, this lawn. And I said, what about the lawn? She said, getting out of control. And I said, well, I've got it, my lawnmower on a shorter cut as we dare, because the lawn, you know, it's summer and it gets dry and it's best to leave a little bit of growth on the lawn or else it goes really dry. I said, but it's looking out of control. And I said, well, my lawnmower, I could have put another ring between the blade and, you know, because it's only a fly mower, it's a postage stamp lawn shed. Well, I still feel it's not quite in control. And she then took me to her shed where she unveiled this supermodel Flymo thing, which would cut down till it was actually scraping the thing. And she'd obviously had a son-in-law or something adjust this thing with the maximum amount of rings between the blade and the spindle, so the thing was actually scraping the ground. And when I'd done that, she said, what about the edges? And I said, well, they look fine, you know, I mean, it is a bit dry, Mrs. Mm-hmm. And she said, I've got a strimmer. So I then got this strimmer, and she's standing there looking at me with her blue rinse and her butterfly spectacles, everything under control, and it's all a complete antiseptic kitchen, you know. I thought, this is an android garden, it needs to be controlled. I felt like Edward Scissorhands, frankly. And I, she said, can you strim round the shed? So I strimmed round the shed. And it's fine, she said, that's better. So I left the place looking like a squaddy haircut, basically. It's completely, it looks like I've given it a number one. The whole garden's a number one. She's happy, it's yellow, there's nothing growing in it. I come back a week later, she said, you cut down my clematis last week. I've been trying to grow that for 2 years, and there was this tiny little clematis that had gone one strand. I was amazed it dared to show its face at all, but I cut it. So that was, I did sort of feel bad about that. Just thinking, God almighty, what kind of people am I working for? That's why I prefer to work for sort of old academics and people in the big houses, because they kind of, you know, I think people in that kind of person doesn't know how to treat someone who's basically in a service industry. They think, they're servants. Yeah, they just think they're servants, and they've got to maintain some sort of control. So it's a bit awkward, really. Well, I know that you're lonely, coming from the cold. Your shoes, they need mending. Your clothes, they look old. Won't you pick never too late, though it's never early to make a mistake. As soon as you wake, although there's been rain and it's coming again, change has to be obviously. Though my friend the sun looks well on the run, he's there. Well, I know that you're waiting, come out from your shell. There'll come a time you'll remember it well, when you take all the good times from chances you, chances you've made, and what you've learned from the bad. It's never too sad, although there's been rain and it's coming again. Change has to be here.
If season were reason, then there'd be no doubt a sequel of changes worth putting you out. But on the question of whether you heard a lie, answer yourself, looking straight in his eyes. Don't you realize, although there's been rain, it's coming again. Change has to be here, obviously. Though my friend the sun looks well on the run, he's there in the distance, if you care to see.
That was My Friend the Sun from Family, from their, I think, second last album, which was called Bandstand. So it was late in 1972, probably November, that I remember listening to it from. Very evocative for me. That was around about the time of what I call my downfall, my depletion, when I finally finished being a silly youth and put away dangerous things and came home and thought we'd better get on with something serious or else we are going to be dead. I was 19, I was very ill, and I remember that track was a real comfort to me. And I also remember sort of realising that no matter how bad things got, you know, that I had things like the garden. In the House of Seven Rooms, as I called it, which was where the scene of my various downfalls, there was a garden there and I used to retreat to that. It was neglected. Occasionally one of the boys, one of the bikers, or somebody would go out there and dig it, or somebody would be found wandering around there in a blanket singing a Pink Fairy song because they'd had too much of this or too much of that. But I used to go and sit out there. That was when I think, having stopped gardening when I was about 13 or something, I began to come back to it then and to realise the value of outdoors, of being outdoors. That was where I really belonged. That was the soul of me. And that track seemed to... It's quite sad, actually. It's My Friend the Sun is well on the run. And it was autumn, and so those last... what I call those last gold ingots of the sun were on the birch tree as the last leaves fell. And it was the kind of the end of the summer. Although it's been rain, it's coming again. Change has to be there, obviously. But My Friend the Sun, he's well on the run. He's there in the distance, if you care to see him. It was a big, big track for me. And a big live favourite for Family. A band who, although they were incredibly popular in Europe, really should have been up there with The Who and the Pink Floyd. And I think it was their talented but very headstrong singer Roger Chapman, who has an attitude a bit like me, that if he doesn't like what someone's saying, he will say so. I think he'll also do something. He'll lob a mic stand. I've seen him lob mic stands at anyone who's causing trouble. You know, even in the days of Love and Peace, if there's a punch-up down in the audience, he'd be down there joining in with it, you know. He's a terrible man. And it's such a good live act. I spoke to him once on the telephone. I interviewed him for Record Collector, which is a music magazine whose listeners actually do read about music and not trouser bottoms or anything or what kind of shirts we're wearing. They're just into the music. So it's quite, you know, it's amazing how many pop stars will talk to them. And I got to talk to some good people. I spoke to Roger Chapman briefly and I said that I'd listened to all his albums. To this day, I still have the entire Family collection, the lot. I picked them up when they were reissued. I've got the lot. They're really what Andy Partridge would call triangular melodies. You think a normal pop group would make the note go, and they make it go, and that's probably why they weren't, you know, they never had a great big breakthrough hit. I think the English are great gardeners because, well, there's several reasons. We're an island nation, and like my dad said, you know, you're either going to be a fisherman or a farmer or a gardener of some sort. But the French are pretty good gardeners, you know, when you come across them. And the Japanese are quite... Japanese have got a completely different way of gardening. We can get onto that a bit later, because when I have been abroad, I do sort of wander around looking at people's gardens a bit. But the English, because we're so crowded here, I think it goes back to the period between the wars, when there was an incredible housing boom. They built 4 million houses in those 20 years between the wars. And of those 4 million houses, 1 million were in the public sector. And it was the age of the ribbon developments and the garden suburbs. And so finally, Mr. Clark of Clerkenwell, who'd been crammed in and may have had a city allotment, became master of his own castle. He put a bit of money down on that semi-detached with the sunburst, you know, window on the door, and he got his own little patch of garden. And the people who really cleaned up were Ransoms of Ipswich, who sold little lawnmowers to people. I'm not exactly sure about this, but I think the allotments came out of that, so that people got this, you know, by way of saying, yes, we've taken your land away in real terms, but in real terms we're giving you all some land back. So they got given four, an allotment is four rods, poles or perches, roughly the same size as one is today. And you were given this because that was the minimal amount of land that they reckoned people would need to grow their vegetables on. And that was how they came about. But as for the gardens, well, Mr. Clark of Clerkenwell got his little castle, and he got his little castle with grounds. And that's what it was. So the English got their gardens, and ran some mowers of Ipswich profited, and which was no bad thing. That is track two, is all I can tell you, of some traditional Koto music. I have one of my most prized CDs, played by Mayasita Sin. And after two trips to Japan, I finally dispatched a Japanese friend of mine, and she sent me back this LP, whose script is all in Japanese, except for the name of the chap. It just said in very small English letters, Mayasita Sin plays traditional Koto music. That's all I know about it. And there's a picture of the chap. I know what a Koto is because I very nearly bought one from an Oriental music shop in Covent Garden called Ray Mann's, which is famous. They sell sitars and gongs. A Koto is a kind of harp in a box, and it's sort of vaguely triangular, I guess you'd call it. One end's thicker than the other because that accommodates the wider strings. And then you can do those trills on it like a harp, but it's more exotic. I don't know, I just really, really liked it. And I nearly bought one, but then I thought, if I bought one, it'd be like all those dilettantes who bought a sitar in the 60s. I looked at gardens when I was in Japan. I looked in a suburban gardens, and when we first stayed there, I don't know why, because they usually put your British rock musicians, which I was in Shinjuku, or the other place where the they're kind of Soho, and the ones where you show Tokyo, but they put us in a place called Meguro, and Meguro is like a businessman's district. It's sort of like, so far as I could ascertain, a bit like being put in City of London or the Barbican or somewhere like that. There didn't appear to be many people living there, but you saw orderly ranks of people going to work. And then as I went to wander around the streets, I noticed there were, in the back streets, little orderly gardens. And it reminded me of French gardens, really, rather than English ones. But the Japanese are big gardeners, but they have a very different idea of gardening to us. The urban Japanese, they couldn't seem to tell me anything. I kept seeing these trees. Now, Tokyo would be very polluted, but there are lots of trees in the streets, in certain streets. And I say, this tree is very interesting because it's obviously absorbing a lot of the pollution and it's obviously capable of surviving with a lot of pollution. What is it? What do you call it? And they were unable to tell me. And finally, after a couple of days, I just reached up, broke a leaf off one of the trees and, trying to find out what it was, I rubbed it between my fingers and it was camphor. So they have camphor trees growing. Yeah. Yeah, the same wood that the Chinese make chests out of to keep the linen in because it's such a good, strong... It's the essence of what, you know, Vic Vapor Rub is camphor. Camphor oil. I just, you know, everything's kind of small and neat. If the Japanese give you anything, which they do, they give you these little presents. They're always immaculately wrapped. In fact, usually there's more wrapping than there is present. And quite often, I mean, it seems terribly impolite, but, you know, I on my 42nd birthday, this box arrived, and inside the box was some wrapping. Then they'd tied that, and there were some nice little straws arranged in a splayed fan pattern, and I undid that, and inside was some more tissue paper. And then in that was a kind of a porcelain, baked porcelain leaf of some sort, of a rough texture. And I said, what is it? I said, there's a leaf. And then another package came in. And finally, I've got five leaves and they're still upstairs. And, you know, to this day, I don't know kind of what they're for. I kind of like not understanding things sometimes. Do you know what I mean? Where I get to a place and it's completely alien, it's like being on the moon. And you think, great, I can just be a tourist here and I can just walk around gaping because I haven't got a clue what anything is. I either like it or I do not like it. It's quite a thing. If the Japanese record company flies me, Captain Sensible, Nell, and, you know, a member of XTC and some other guys out, they must think something's going to happen. So, and it did. We got screamed at by girls. A bit late, really, because we were all about 40 by this time. So, although one or two of the members of the party liked it.
My father says there's only one perfect view, and that's the view of the sky over our heads. I expect your father has been reading Dante.
That was The Death of a Supernaturalist by The Divine Comedy. Neil Hannon, a really formidable musical intelligence, you know, someone that I... Very few people who work in the same area of pop music as I worked in, where I just think, God, better be careful around this guy, because he's actually very good. And that's probably my favourite Divine Comedy track, The Death of a Supernaturalist. Professor Winston loved a fire. He'd don thin coat and wander out. Anything that I can do, he'd ask me. I'd disguise my doubt. Fragile in his 70s, boyish in some other ways, I handed him hide gloves, a rake, and watched him while he fed the blaze. The bonfire bright against the grey, our custom in those old Decembers, standing in encroaching darkness, gazing into orange embers, from the cuttings, canes and deadwood, apple, rose and artichoke, came the wraiths of vanquished summer, snaking out of sparks and smoke. Further off, the coughing lorries, chucking out their mucky load, mumbled at the grumbling buses, squeezing into Station Road, while Professor Winston's bonfire billowed through the afternoon, till the final wisps of wood smoke rose to meet the churchyard moon. This is the autumn when the gardens are haunted. This old doctor I worked for, I used to love autumn. But I remember him looking at me with his great big blue watery eyes, and he's saying, "Well, I don't like it," he said. "I think it's a bloody melancholy time." And then another gardening customer, a female academic I knew, told me a story about the house where she was living, which is out on the Alresford Road. And she'd said, I'd said, "What do you know about the history of this place?" And because it was a big garden, you know, I mean, good acre of it stretching back with a little bit of woodland that ended in a railway line. You know, you could walk a long way up there, you know, walk out of sight of the house easily, be well away, there are plenty of little corners in it. And she said that when the house was first built, or the house that had been there earlier, a woman had lived there, and the garden had got too much for her to manage. And she'd employed a gardener to work there. She was born on her own, maybe a widow, a gardener of about her own age, different sort of class, I suppose, and he'd worked there. And the gardener had become ill, and she'd nursed him, you know, until he died, which is a very affecting sort of story. And I always felt when I was working that garden, before I'd even heard that story, when I was working up in the woods, because the academic herself was, you know, a singular woman. She didn't want the place quaffed. I said, "We ought to have this out because it'll spread." She said, "Oh, should we?" And I said, I realised it wasn't a question. She was saying, "You know, you don't tell me what we should have." I said, "Well, I don't know, most people think that if you leave these things in here, then woof, that will happen, so maybe you best to keep it under guard." She said, "Well, I don't really mind them." I said, "Fine, no problem. I'm here to, you know, do what you want." But she liked certain of the flora that was in the rough, wild bit of wood to flourish. So occasionally I would just be required to go in there and cut enough, light prune some of the trees in there to allow the light to break through the canopy so that these flowers, the wood anemones and things would come up, or to clear the brambles out to give the wildflowers a chance. So that was the kind of work I was employed on. Before the great wind nudged it over, 87, mid-October, there the standard Blenheim tree, jewelled with apples, used to be, arms out like an autumn umpire, laden down with players' stuff, groaning to the wind, "Enough!" Leaders, laterals, spurs and shoots, ivy suckers scarred its trunk. Now the tree leaned over, drunk. Friday morning, barely light, the gardener surveyed the sight. The ancient branches, sideways on, crashed down through the outhouse tiles. Shrubs and splintered wood lay round. The fruit was strewn across the ground. A sodden windfall going sour. The gusts of 60 miles an hour raked the leaves from off the lawn, drying a tear-streaked sky at dawn. And whenever I was working up there, not always, but I sometimes felt that someone was, you know, at my shoulder, or at least I didn't feel it was disapproving, but I constantly felt like I was being watched up there. And it wasn't her, because she'd be out teaching or be off somewhere. I think gardeners leave some of themselves behind in a garden. I mean, I really feel like this one guy who died, professor, and I still look after the gardens. They're still waiting for the house to be sold. But I've done that garden on and off for 20 years. Even when I came back from touring Japan, I'd have a spare few days, and he'd say, "Are you around?" I'd say, "You know, I'm not really gardening anymore. I'm supposed to be a pop star in Japan." But I'd say, "Ah, sod it, let's go and sort the hedges out," you know, and I'd be there for a couple of days. In fact, I meant to get there this morning, but it rained. But I will do that garden until it's sold. But the house has not been sold, and it's going to be really odd when finally someone does buy it. And you know, unless, of course, I won the lottery, in which case I'd buy it just so I could do the garden. But, yeah, I think gardeners do put their personality on a garden. And even if the garden becomes neglected for ages afterwards, and then you come back in, you as you cut the wilderness away, you begin to uncover, and you can begin to get a feel for what the old, and it usually is an old man or an old woman who had loved this garden before, maybe even 20 years before, you begin to get a feel for what style of gardener they were and what they liked.
When the sun beats down and I lie on the bench, I can always hear them talk.
There's always been Ethel. She could wake up because of tidying room now. And then Mr. Lewis listened to time that he was out on his own.
I'm just a lawnmower. You can tell me by the way I walk.
That was another aspect of gardening. You know, I used to wonder about Peter Gabriel because I knew a bit about gardening. I thought, You know, he's a public schoolboy and everything, but you kind of wonder if he ever had done anything like that, or if he was doing that great hobby of Englishmen who don't do anything, like writing about hero-worshipping workmen. I mean, some of my friends are guilty of it, and I'm guilty of it myself to an extent. I mean, Andy Partridge from XTC is... I thought when I met him, he would be this guy who'd, you know, really had a few farm labouring jobs, because he seemed to know so much about it. But he doesn't. He's real. He's just the greatest armchair ruralist I've ever met. He knows everything about it. And what, you know, when he was mixing the drums down, and I said, Andy, he said, I can't get past this stuff. And I said, no, it's a Japonica quince. It was grown on a pergola in his tiny little back suburban garden. And he said, well, what should I do? I said, we have to prune it. And he said, we'll get a geezer in to do it. I said, well, I could do that, Andy. And I said, how do you do it? I said, well, I just need a chair or something to stand on, or a little stepladder, or I can get up the top bits and I can prune it round the pergola and make it neat while you're, you know, mixing down those drum things. You don't need me. So I climbed from his ladder. I'm only about five steps up or something, with a pair of secateurs, which I found. And he said, are you going to be all right up there? And I said, yes, I'm a gardener, you know. But I thought, because he'd written this thing, Love on a Farm, Boy's Wages and all this stuff, that he would know, you know, all about, you know, different types of carts and how they were built, and that at some point that he'd got his shoulders into it. But he never had, you know. When we were walking around the park, he was always telling me to slow down a bit and things like that, you know. And I wonder if Peter Gabriel was the same thing. I mean, he didn't so much. There was something about the way that was written about him. Me, I'm just a lawnmower. You can tell me by the way I walk.
See the splashing of the kingfisher flashing to the water, and a river of green is sliding unseen beneath the trees, laughing as it passes through the endless summer, making for the sea.
Joan Hickson lived in this village for a long time. And she talked to me, as she would see me gardening. And that made me all right, because it meant I wasn't a fawning fan and I wasn't a fellow artist trying to break into the trade. So when she came out on her perambulations with her basket, it was perfectly all right to talk to me. And she'd say, the wallflowers are looking very lovely, aren't they? I said, it's very cold spring, you know. And I remember before she got the Miss Marple gig, because that woman had always worked as an actress. And people in the village were a bit mean about her, really. She was a working actress. She never stopped working. She never was without a gig. And the Miss Marple thing was a big one. And then people said, oh, well, I preferred Margaret Rutherford. I don't think she's any good in it. And I'll tell you something about Joan Hickson. She was friends with Agatha Christie. And Agatha Christie said, if we ever get this televised or whatever, you've got it. Well, as it happens, Margaret Rutherford got the first one. But quite rightly, Joan Hickson got it. But a guy who I knew was driving her, and she was being driven through a down-at-heel area of London, and saying, yeah, area like Balham was at the time, and she'd say, what kind of person do you imagine lives here, Stanley, you know? And once, she was in the station waiting room one cold morning, she'd got a bit part somewhere, this is before Miss Marple, and I was waiting to go off to my kitchen porter job, and I was puffing away on a roll-up. And she was standing there in her fur coat, fiddling with her watch like it was a faulty time machine. She was kind of saying in a bewildered kind of way, oh, in the old days, the studio used to send a car. And I was thinking, yes, I expect they did. But she got that gig as Miss Marple, and that, you know, it was popular in about 28 different countries, and people used to say, you know, where does Miss Marple live? And everyone in the village, to a man, would say, oh, I don't know, she does live here, we don't see her much. They never gave the game away. No one ever said, she lives there. Because we all knew, you know, she lived. She deserved a bit of peace and quiet, and that was good, that tacit conspiracy of the people of Wivenhoe never would tell the fans where she lived, so they couldn't nick the fittings or something like that, or peer over the wall, or lift their children up to look at her. Not that she'd have been sunbathing at that age. That's right. She did have a garden, and she did like gardening. She was a doctor's wife, Dr. Butler, and she was either called by the women in the shops when Playstall had shops. She was either called Mrs. Butler or Joan, that's all. And people didn't pester her, and she would talk to me about gardening. Many times we had a conversation, just small talk about how the wallflowers were doing, or, you know, whether it would be good for the, you know, or how lovely the laburnum tree was looking and things like that. And she just thought of me in a nice, cosy way as a village gardener until one day she read an article about me that I'd got a record out and all the rest of it, but that I refused to fly to America because, A, I wasn't really interested, and, B, I didn't like planes, because it's a bit like being in hospital being on a plane, isn't it? And, you know, thinking, are you all right? You know, and things like that. And they take everything away from you and you're not in charge. And it's even more so now. And so she stopped me in the street once and she put her hand on my arm and said, do you know, I've just read about you in the paper and well done, you've got a record out. I heard you were making a comeback. I was thinking, it's not exactly a comeback, you know, it's a kind of just starting kind of thing, you know. And she said, and I've heard that you won't fly. And I said, no, I'm not really very keen on it. And she said, look me in the eye, and she said, but, you know, people like us, dear, we must. And I said, people like us? And that was kind of a shame, really, because after that I wasn't a gardener anymore, and I really enjoyed little chats but, I mean, her memory began to get a bit patchy after that, so a couple of years after that she forgot everything and I was back being a gardener again, which was fine by me.